I've actually come at this question from an economics perspective, so I'm a bit out of my depth here in a room full of legal experts, so please excuse any poor use of legal language. But I was interested as part of my PhD research to examine the question of how, when you grant legal rights to rivers, how does it impact people's behaviour around use? So how does it impact transaction costs? How does it impact the behaviour of users and managers? And so today what I'm going to do is give a bit of a brief overview and maybe clarify some or shine some more light on the questions that might come up about Maunga Nui. And I'm going to kind of do a who, what, where, why, how. So I'm not going to do a deep dive into what my PhD research was really examining, but I'm happy to answer any specific questions in the time for the panel discussion later on. So it's a bit of overview as well. The Whanganui River in New Zealand is its third longest river, and so its longest navigable river, and runs from the centre of the North Island up and down to come out about an hour and a half north of Wellington, if anybody's familiar with New Zealand, in a town called Whanganui. And there's a range of competing uses over the river, from an extractive from an economic perspective, it's 82% of the headwaters of the Whanganui are extracted for hydropower. So that leaves only 18% of the headwaters coming down into the river. And this is called consumptive flow because it's taken out of the system, it's shot down a series of canals into Lake Taupo, and then flows out down the Waikato River system. And the water that comes out of the Whanganui supplies about 5% of New Zealand's electricity. The river itself has high conservation values. It's home to several species of endangered native fish, and also the pheal or the blue duck also lives on the river. This is a photo of a couple of friends and I that canoed the river a couple of years ago. It's got high recreational and tourist values. It's known as one of New Zealand's great walks, even though it's a canoe trip. And so you have about 6,000 people kayaking that river each year. There's also a number of jet boat operators. But perhaps the most important value for this river is its high cultural value. And for the people of Whanganui, so Whanganui iwi, there's a really strong cultural connection with that river, and for them, the saying of ko o te awa, ko te awa ko o, encapsulates the relationship that the people of Whanganui have with this river. And that relationship is, I'm the river and the river is me. It kind of ties in with some of the things Virginia was just talking about in the previous session. And so this relationship that Whanganui iwi have with the river is what motivated this change in legal status for the Whanganui River. And so it's quite different to the India case, in that it was conflicting worldviews that had stemmed ownership claims since 1873 over who owned and who had property rights to this river. So it was known as, or recognised as, New Zealand's longest running court case. And what they were trying to do in a pragmatic form is recognise and encapsulate Whanganui iwi's worldview in a Western legal format. They acknowledged that they haven't done it perfectly, but this was a pragmatic way of trying to better acknowledge the worldview and that connection that Whanganui iwi share with the river. From a political perspective, granting the Whanganui River legal rights was a way of also navigating ownership claims. From from the beginning of negotiations, which came out of Treaty of Waitangi claims, the Crown said, we're not prepared to give iwi rights or ownership of this river. And iwi, similarly, was not happy with the Crown or the New Zealand government retaining ownership. So this was basically developed as a third pathway, a third ownership pathway that allowed them to overcome some of those competing interests. And interestingly, although this sounds like a really dramatic shift, it's kind of an evolutionary transition. So it did come out of 8 years of negotiation. So this was the final result, that they went into it knowing they had to find a settlement that came out of these ownership disputes in the Treaty of Waitangi settlements. And then since the 1980s, there had been a progression in New Zealand where you were getting a really significant shift in the way that water was being managed. There was a lot of co-management arrangements that were coming out. And this, in this case, it's just another step in that pathway. In 2010, an agreement came out for the Waikato River, and that wasn't viewed as suitable for the Whanganui, and they had to do something more, but it was just another step. At the beginning of March, 14th of March, this legislation passed its third reading in Parliament, and then on the 20th of March got the Royal Assent. And so we saw New Zealand granting legal status to the Whanganui. And so how did this happen? In 4 minutes, I'm going to cover a lot. So I apologise. So this was a legislative change rather than a judicial change. And first and foremost, the legislation recognises the relationship that Whanganui iwi has with the river, and it gives the river and its catchment a legal identity, known as Te Awa Tukua. Property rights to the riverbed are vested in Te Awa Tukua, so transferred from the Crown to the new legal entity. Appointed guardians are tasked with enhancing Te Awa Tukua's health and well-being. And so these guardians, one are appointed by the Crown and one are appointed by iwi. And they have a legislative requirement to make unanimous decisions. There's also a broader institutional framework that is developed through the legislation that is missing in the India case. And firstly, you have a strategy group which is made up of 17 individuals who have or representatives who have interests in the river. This includes iwi, it includes members of local government, it also includes Genesis, who run the dam, or the Tongariro Power Scheme. This strategy group is tasked with basically developing a catchment management plan for the system. And there's also an advisory group for the guardians, and everybody is going meant to make decisions based on the values that are meant to encapsulate the spirit of Te Awa Tukua. Okay, so this kind of shifts it from a rules-based to a values-based system, which presents its own sets of complexity. There's funding, over $30 million provided by the Crown for both implementing and operationalising this agreement. However, this agreement does not create rights over water. And I think this is going to be an interesting development. It creates rights over the riverbed and it purposefully excludes water. Water is really contentious in New Zealand at the moment. And introducing water rights into this, I know it seems this can be a point of discussion later on, but it was a way of getting this through, basically. In terms of the Whanganui possible outcomes, this sort of comes out of the summaries of my PhD research as well, which I'm happy to shine further light on if need be. But it establishes an interesting new property rights arrangement where property rights are being transferred from basically a state ownership model through to this new idea where the river is able to speak for itself and hold property rights accordingly. It transforms the governance arrangement into a bottom-up system. Because there's this strategy group that's developed out of community members who are meant to guide the development of this catchment management plan, that really stops it being a top-down model and kind of creates a bottom-up model. It means that there's an increase in decision-making responsibility for the judiciary in places of, now you're going to have two individuals, rather than the legislature making decisions, you've got an individual making decisions on behalf of the river. And some of my economic work suggests that there could be an increase in transaction costs associated with bargaining over use when you've got the dam bargaining with the river itself. But what you might also see is that you'll have a redistribution of water within the system. And that may not be a surprise, but for policymakers interested in looking for alternative ways that could increase environmental flows, this could be a useful alternative approach to consider or at least add to the policymakers' toolbox.
Great, thanks. Okay, so thank you very much. And finally for this section, we have Liz McPherson, and Lisa Carithas.
Yes.
And they're going to give us a perspective more from South America, I think. So Liz did her PhD here at Melbourne, looking at water rights and Indigenous perspectives and commercial rights in relation to water in Australia, but comparing with Colombia. We're going to talk about Colombia. And I believe Liz is going to talk for about 10 minutes and then Lisa's going to add a few words. Lisa is a climate change and energy lawyer and works for Transparency International. Good.
I'm glad of that.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. I'll grab the clicker.
Yeah.
Thanks everyone for having me here.